Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I had a nice plan for a talk. I worked on a lot yesterday afternoon. I was going to talk about how if you Google why study philosophy, the web pages that pop up largely from philosophy departments trying to convince you to major in their subject matter so they don't get fired, largely list a bunch of either instrumental benefits studying philosophy, like it improves your LSAT scores. It probably doesn't so much. Largely, it probably is people who study philosophy are the sort of people who can do well on the LSAT anyway, but we don't need to get into rehashing that debate. Or it like helps you critically think so you can make a lot of money in business or things like this. Or sometimes they'll say it's fun. And I was going to take this, like, yes, we have our nice threefold division between the good, the useful, the pleasant, and the befitting. And I was going to say everyone in modern culture pursues philosophy because it's useful or pleasant, but we should really do it because it's befitting, because anything else corrupts the activity. And then last night at 7:30, Father Ambrose just gave a better version of that talk in the first half of what he said yesterday. And so for that reason, I've decided to pivot somewhat. Not entirely. There will be residences with the same idea, but really what I'm going to do is sort of building on what he said. And I'm going to assume, as people here at the Thomistic Institute, that you probably already are inclined to think that, yes, the reason we do philosophy is for its own sake, is in some sense because of a love of knowledge, a love of truth, a love of understanding, and not because you think it'll help you get a job. You know, the Thomistic Institute's great, but I don't think people sign up for it as, like, an excellent networking organization. And so what I want to instead talk about is, assuming you really do have a kind of earnest desire for truth, what are some of the dangers that can lead you astray? And I want to focus on four at the beginning, because they're the four dangers that I think have most commonly led me astray in my life, and that I only found diagnosed by reading certain great works of philosophy. And I want to talk about how they have, in various ways, derailed parts of my own intellectual life. And then I want to draw a kind of general lesson about what this looks like and what it means for how it is that we can be a philosophical person. So that's the sort of pivot that I want to talk about here. And so on page 2 is where the handout now really starts. And to begin, I want to ask the question, when we say, why be philosophical, we want to have some sense of what it is to be philosophical. Because presumably being philosophical doesn't mean you teach philosophy classes. I know many people who teach philosophy classes who are not philosophical. And I know many people who are philosophical who don't teach philosophy classes. It presumably doesn't mean you take philosophy classes. It doesn't even necessarily mean you're disposed to read lots of great philosophical books. But that one's getting, I think, closer to a true correlation. I want to suggest something that perhaps is overly pious, but I want to say that what it really is to be philosophical is to exhibit the kind of attitude that Socrates articulates in a passage of the Gorgias, and it's that first big passage on page 2 of the handout. Socrates says this when he's talking to his interlocutor Gorgias, and he says, Gorgias, I only want to have this conversation with you if you're the sort of person who is like me. Because most people who you discuss with don't want to get to the truth. They want to win the argument. And so they start with a disagreement. One person thinks one thing, one person thinks another, and then they're going to argue. And there's two things that argument could be directed towards. It could be both of them trying to figure out which one of them is right, or it could be both of them trying to convince the other that they are right. And that first type of dialogue, Socrates thinks, is the philosophical one. The second is not philosophical, but argumentative or combative. And he says this. He says, I would only want to discuss with you if you're the sort of person I am, which at the end of the paragraph is this, and what kind of man am I? One of those who would be pleased to be refuted if I said anything untrue, and who would be pleased to refute anyone who says anything untrue. One who, however, wouldn't be any less pleased to be refuted than to refute. So I am someone equally willing to be corrected as to correct. Because my concern is not that I happen to already be right, or that I win the argument, or that I appear smart. Instead, my concern is that I realize what is true. That, I think, is a nice way to sum up what it is to be philosophical. And what I want to talk about now is four ways in which you can really at first be motivated by love of truth, or be trying to be motivated by love of truth, but turn out not to be once you see clearly what you're after. And the first one is already intonated in the first part of that paragraph, but there's a full discussion of it in Plato's Republic. And here in Plato's Republic, Socrates says the following when he's explaining why you shouldn't let 18 to 22-year-olds study philosophy. And isn't it one lasting precaution not to let them taste arguments while they're young? I don't suppose it's escaped your notice that when young people get their first taste of arguments, they misuse it by treating it as a kind of game of contradiction. They imitate those who've refuted them by refuting others themselves, and like puppies, they enjoy dragging and tearing those around them with their arguments. But an older person won't want to take part in such madness. He'll imitate someone who's willing to engage in discussion or to look for the truth, rather than someone who plays at contradiction for sport. Some biographical backstory. I was very into formal debate in high school. Right? I was on the debate team. I was very good. At least in the type of debate I did, I was arguably one of the best in the country. I also really liked to win. Right? I really enjoyed winning arguments. And because I really enjoyed winning arguments, I read a lot of philosophy because reading a lot of philosophy helped me to win arguments. And at first I thought that at a certain point I was no longer reading philosophy to win arguments. I was instead reading philosophy because I love the philosophy. And that was to some extent true in high school. And so I decided to major in philosophy in college. And when I started majoring in philosophy in college, I would get to go to philosophy talks. They'd bring in colloquium speakers who would give these talks. And I loved these talks. But I especially loved the Q&A. And I thought for a long time that I loved the Q&A because it provided me an opportunity to really get to the heart of the issue. It was only a little while later that I realized really what I loved about the Q&A was I loved to be able to win the Q&A by asking a question that would stump the speaker. And my goal going into these talks was not to figure out what was true and what the person said, but to stump them and point out a contradiction or point out an argument they can't deal with or in some other way show that they're wrong. Now, why is this? I think the reason for this temptation is really quite simple, right? And the reason it's quite simple is because we really do want the truth. And because we want the truth, we want to be able to defend that what we say is true. Because we want to have the truth. We want to have had the truth. It's important to us that we be right because the truth matters. But in wanting to be right, what is one mark of what it would be to be right? What is one mark of having the truth? It's the ability to win an argument. If you can win an argument, likely your views are true, all else equal. Between two similarly skilled arguers, the one who is right, we should hope, this is how sort of democracy of ideas is supposed to work out in our society, we hope the better argument will win. And so being able to win the argument is a good sign, it's a good mark of being correct. The problem, however, is that winning is also fun. And because it's also fun, it's very easy to get misled away from the love of the truth to the love of the winning, and in consequence, cease to actually get at the truth with the questions you ask. I learned less philosophy than I otherwise could have by asking the tricky question that would stump the speaker, rather than the question that really clarified my own misunderstanding. Because if I ask about that, I have to admit that I did something wrong or didn't understand, which was the opposite of what I really wanted to do. That's the first corruption. Second corruption I want to talk about, and it's similar. But where the first corruption is between me and the interlocutor, I want to win. And I want to win even in a one-on-one conversation. The second was not so much I wanting to win, but I want to appear as though I had won. I want to appear that way to the audience. If you never read Plato's Gorgias, you should read it. It's my all-time favorite work of philosophy. And one of the reasons I love it is because Socrates has successive conversations with three interlocutors. Gorgias, Polus, and Callicles, and each one fails to finish out the conversation because each one, it turns out, is not interested in the truth, but instead interested in looking like they have the truth to other people, and so keeps saying things that will appeal to the crowd, derailing the conversation. And in the end, Socrates has to finish the conversation with himself because he's the only one who's really willing to follow the argument where it leads. And we get this discussion in it, this is the sort of first paragraph there, where Socrates is talking to Polus and he says, "My wonderful man, you're trying to refute me in oratorical style, the way people in law courts do when they think you're refuting some claim. There, too, one side thinks it's refuting the other when it produces many reputable witnesses on behalf of the arguments it presents, while the person who asserts the opposite produces only one witness and none at all. This refutation is worthless as far as truth is concerned. For it might happen sometimes an individual is brought down by the false testimony of many reputable people. Now, too, nearly every Athenian and alien will take your side on the things you're saying, if it's witnesses you want to produce against me to show that what I say isn't true. Nevertheless, though I'm only one person, I don't agree with you. You don't compel me. Instead, you produce many false witnesses against me and try to banish me from my property, the truth. What Socrates thinks happens is that we stop making arguments that we think are right and instead start making arguments that we think will appeal to the people who are listening. Not to the person we're talking to. You should, when you make arguments, appeal to shared premises with the person you're discussing, because that's how you two together leverage your way into truth. But what can instead happen is you start making an appeal to arguments irrespective of the person you're talking to agrees, because the people listening to the conversation agree. And it's a way to get them on your side. Now, why would this be true? Well, last night, Father Ambrose talked about how we can tell a sort of plausible evolutionary story about our love of truth. And I think we can actually push that farther, right? It's not so much that we'd have a plausible evolutionary reason to love truth. What a lot of the evolutionary psychologists tell us is what we have is a strong evolutionary desire to look like we're correct. That most of our reasonability seems to evolve to justify ourselves to those in our community. Because it turns out you having a wrong belief about most things is pretty unlikely to result in you dying, but having a belief that gets you shunned by your community pretty much guarantees you're going to die, at least in the sort of evolutionary context in which human beings found themselves. And so there's lots of good evidence from lots of cognitive psychology that when we reason, we are almost entirely, or not entirely, but we are largely, without realizing it, actually being motivated by the question of what's going to make us fit in with our in-group. Which beliefs are going to win us approval as opposed to which beliefs are true. And this is, I think, a profoundly insidious temptation for those of us because it replaces that concern for truth with another concern that tends to mark the truth, being I'll get people to agree with you. Because it is the case that truth is the sort of thing we should converge to and agree on because it's something external to us. But that convergence can happen not because everyone is converging towards the truth, but instead because everyone converges towards the shelling point, towards the point of commonality. And when everyone tries to do that, you basically have good reason to think what you're going to be stuck in is a fad. And that can be a very, very dangerous thing that you have to watch out for. Corruption number three is probably the simplest and most fundamental, which is an awful lot of what we think goes under the heading of pursuing truth. In fact, in reality, is trying to rationalize the things we already think. So the first two were about something like dialogue, conversation, something that happens publicly. The scary thing is that this same sort of temptation, not to get to the truth, but instead to defend what you already think or what your community already thinks, it turns out will afflict even yourself in the privacy of your own thoughts. That study after study after study after study says that human beings tend to really struggle to critically come up with arguments for things they don't already believe. That our reasoning system tends to kick into overdrive primarily in order to vindicate the thing that we already think. We start with our conclusions, and we come up with reasons after the fact to vindicate those conclusions, rather than coming to reasons and then working your way to the conclusions first. And so here, it's true that what you engage in is reasoning. It really is reasoning. It really is identifying premises that support your conclusions and identifying the structure that supports it. And this is all, in some sense, a truth-governed activity, but it has flipped the pursuit of truth on its head. You start with the assumption that what you have is true and then come up with reasons it's true, rather than starting with reasons to ensure that you converge at the truth in the end. And this is, I think, probably the thing that happens more when you have debates in philosophy or ethics, things like that, than anything else. I spend, when I teach bioethics, the first 2 weeks of my course warning students that I worry this class is bad for them. I say the problem with teaching you bioethics is I'm going to teach you a lot of reasoning skills, a lot of useful ways that you can analyze arguments and break them down, identify fallacies, and insulate yourself from criticism. But study after study after study, well, actually, there are only like four studies that tested this in particular, but those four studies have found that when you teach people critical thinking skills, they don't get better at getting to the truth. They instead get better at staying with the thing they already thought. If you, for instance, look at people's ability to like understand statistics, you find that it makes them better at coming up with narratives that explain how statistics support their conclusions, and not much better at actually getting the right conclusion when it's about something that's sort of politically charged. So they'll do studies where they like sort people into like high statistical understanding and low statistical understanding and give them something they don't care about, like the efficacy of skin creams. And when you ask about the efficacy of skin creams, they'll converge on the right answer if they have high ability. But if you put the same question and put it in the context of something like gun control, there you'll see a convergence, where the people with high statistical ability actually move away depending on which side of the position they already held. Here's this lovely passage from C.S. Peirce. I like this because people sometimes talk about this as though it's like a new recent discovery that Jonathan Haidt made in the last 30 years, but that's nonsense, right? So here's Jonathan Haidt writing in the 1800s. Reason is, of its very essence, egotistical. In many matters, it acts on the fly on the wheel. Do not doubt that the bee thinks it has a good reason for making the end of its cell as it does. But I should be very much surprised to learn that its reason had solved the problem as that instinct had solved. Men many times fancy that they act from reason. When in point of fact, the reasons they attribute to themselves are nothing but excuses, which unconscious instinct invents to satisfy the teasing whys of the ego. The extent of this self-delusion is such as to render philosophical rationalism a farce. He goes on to say, the scientific man is not in the least wedded to his conclusions. He risks nothing upon them. He stands ready to abandon one or all as soon as experience opposes them. Some of them I grant, he is in the habit of calling established truth, but that merely means propositions to which no competent man today demurs. It seems probable that any given proposition of this sort will remain for a long time upon the list of propositions to be admitted. Still, it may be futile tomorrow, and if so, the scientific man will be glad to have gotten rid of an error. There is thus no proposition at all in the science which answers to the conception of belief. There's a really fascinating move that Peirce makes later in this paper, which I was going to make if I'd given the original talk, where he says, because of this, it's actually very, very important that you not think the reason you do philosophy is because it's useful. Because if you think it's really, really important, like, you need to get the right philosophical views because otherwise you won't live a life of virtue. Or you need to get the right philosophical views of otherwise you are not going to be able to live well in some fashion. Peirce thinks that by attaching that kind of moral value to your philosophical reasoning, it's going to make it almost impossible for you to have the sort of dispassionate interest in whatever this happens to be. And this is held up by psychology. Remember, if you ask people statistical understanding about skin creams they don't care about, they can reason well about it. But if you ask them about something that matters to them, they cease to be able to do so. And so when you feel like philosophy is of vital importance, you need to know what the ethical truth is, because otherwise how are you going to live well? There's a very, very real danger that you are likely going to live worse, because you will just rationalize the thing that it already mattered to you to think. And it really requires, I would have said yesterday, a real act of faith, a willingness to follow the argument wherever it leads, because you know that the truth is not going to be affected by what you end up thinking. The truth is out there and real. And even if you can't come to the conclusion by argument that God exists, God still exists regardless. God's existence does not hang on your ability to show that he does. And so you can openly follow the argument where it leads, knowing that none of that makes a difference to whether or not God is who he is. Okay. Number four. And this one's more subtle. When you pursue an end, say aesthetic, there's a beautiful piece of nature or a beautiful painting. When you pursue this beautiful painting or this beautiful piece of nature, you can do all sorts of practical things because it's beautiful. You can cancel your next appointment so you can spend more time looking at it. You can get a better vantage point so that you can look at it some more clearly. You could build a ramp to the overlook so that people in wheelchairs could come look at it as well. You could text a friend that they have to come and see this new movie because it's just a piece of artistic brilliance. These are all what I'm going to call practical responses to beauty. They're practical responses to beauty, and that they try to bring it about that you are in contact with the beauty. They see it as good that you or others are in contact with the beauty, and what they care about is that contact. Note how different those responses are from when you're actually looking at the beautiful thing itself. When you're actually looking and gazing at the beautiful thing itself, you're no longer in the process of manipulating to bring it about that you're engaged with it. It makes sense to spend less time looking at it now if that means you can come back later and spend more time looking at it later. There's a kind of consequentialist kind of practical reasoning about your contact with the beauty, which is fitting. But when you actually look at the beauty, when you're actually engaged in seeing what is beautiful, that kind of reasoning no longer makes sense. The same kind of thing is true of truth. We can do all sorts of things to try to bring it about that we have more access to truth later on. We can choose to go to a major in something because we think we'll learn more majoring in this rather than something else. But when you're actually engaged in the thought process, that kind of consequentialist reasoning just falls away. It makes no sense. You cannot choose to believe something false now because you think it'll let you believe more true things in the future. To believe in the truth, when you really are looking at the truth, what you care about is not that I have the truth, it is the truth. That is what motivates you. And there's a sense in which the ego itself drops away. The way Aquinas talks about this is he talks about the fittingness of the object and the pleasure of resting in that object. And he says it's the primacy of the fittingness of the object that explains why we take pleasure in it. So it's not the pleasure that's primary, it's the object itself, the goodness of the object itself, which is what we care about. And so there's another kind of error, one in which we come to love not the truth, but our possession of the truth as what's primary. So from C.S. Lewis's Lone in Wartime, we have this passage which I've always loved. The intellectual life is not the only road to God, nor the safest, but we find it to be a road, and it may be the pointed road for us. Of course, it'll be so only so long as we keep the impulse pure and disinterested. That is the great difficulty. As the author of the Theologica Germanica says, controversial book, but interesting, has some good stuff in it. We may come to love knowledge on knowing more than the thing known, to delight not in the exercise of our talents, but in the fact that they are ours, or even in the reputation they bring us. Every success in the scholar's life increases this danger. He gives another example talking about art later on. He says in a different book, I've had to recover from that. It was all a snare when talking about the artist who paints. Ink and catgut and paint were necessary down there, but they were also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn away from the love of the thing he tells to the love of his telling it. Tell down in deep hell, they cannot be interested in God at all, but only in what they say about him. For it doesn't stop being interested in paint, you know. They sink lower, become interested in their own personalities and in nothing but their own reputations. So here are, I think, four corruptions. Four corruptions that can go from you really are loving the truth to no longer loving the truth. And what happens? Well, you love the truth, but we're embodied creatures. And because we're embodied creatures, we have lower appetites and even higher appetites. And these lower and higher appetites don't grasp the truth itself, but instead grasp marks of the truth. They can pay attention to, oh, I won the argument. Or, oh, people agree with me. Or, oh, I'm getting all those nods and approval. Or, oh, it all fits so elegantly together. And these marks of the truth, we are creatures that respond to those marks of the truth. Because we're embodied things and not mere intellects. And because we respond to these, and because we're made by a loving God, we find it pleasant when we respond to these things. Because all of us, and not only our intellect, cares about truth in this way. But because we find these marks of truth pleasant, over time we can come to care more and more about the marks or the appearances as opposed to that truth itself. And this is, I think, a recipe for how you go from being a philosophical kind of person to ceasing to be a philosophical kind of person without ever realizing that that's what's happened. Now, I talked about these four because they're the four that apply most clearly in my own life. But once you have that recipe in place, I think you can easily see there are other sorts of temptations that I think are very common today. And I want to just mention two of them because I think they're common today, even though they haven't been the four that have, I think, derailed so much of my life. The first, and I have these examples at the end, one mark of truth is that sensation of, aha, it all clicks into place. Sometimes when you really understand something, you kind of get the sensation of, oh, I now see it all. It all fits together. It's all so elegant. And that really can be a mark that you've gotten to the truth. But if you come to pursue that aha moment, you're going to look for everything to fit into place too easily. And you're going to end up with is something that is, I think, a recipe for certain kinds of conspiratorial thinking. Another version of this, we often, if you really love the truth, have to be willing to stand up for the truth even when it's unpopular, even when people disagree. But it's very easy to take that mark of the truth, a willingness to stand up even when people disagree, and come to care about that, to care about the edginess of that what you say isn't what people think. And you come away caring about saying things people disagree with, as opposed to the truth. Because a willingness to say what people disagree with can itself be a mark of caring about the truth, truly. I think this is fairly common, it seems, amongst young people today, this kind of desire for edginess, replacing a desire for what truth would have previously been. So all of these, I think, are ways in which, once you understand the sort of thing we are, a thing that pursues the truth, but often pursues the truth by means of appearances, you always have to be careful to not let the appearances draw you away from the thing that you really care about. And that's the only way to be the kind of philosophical person that Socrates describes at the outset in the Gorgias, one who's willing to refute anyone who says what's untrue and willing to be refuted in turn, but no more willing to refute than be refuted. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Benson.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.